A very warm welcome back to you, Venerable. So wonderful to see you again. I don't know if your week has been a very long week or it's just gone by in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, well, that's what happens, I think, with old age. All I remember every day is getting out of bed. I think I just did this a second ago, you know. And every night I go to bed, it's like a second ago I went to bed. So I think it goes very quickly. It's scary, isn't it?
It is scary.
Let's make the most of it. For this 4-6 hours, we're going to make the most of it. We're going to fill ourselves up with Buddha's views so we have enough to chew on for the next 6 months. That's the plan. Okay.
And Venerable, I've got an offering to start the day off with. So I'm just going to spill around. So, and I'll tell you the story about this one.
Miffy's renowned for her amazing creative offering. She's fantastic, I tell you.
So it's called Aqua Buddha, because I'm not sure if you've seen the movie Aquaman, but pretty spectacular movie and really amazing for other realms. So I was very inspired and thought there's got to be a Buddha there in Aqua World. So we've got Aqua Buddha, who has, instead of King Neptune, we have the Buddha of the sea, and there's the two fishies jumping out of the sea of samsara, and a little seal finding refuge on a rock. And cocktail swizzle sticks as a blissful halo made of light. So,
how many have you got of these? You make one a week, or you've got them all lined up somewhere?
I'd love to say that I make one a week, but no, I have them all lined up. But this is the first time that they've had a public outing to you.
I'm so happy, darling. They're just totally gorgeous. I'd love to see them all. Can you send me emails and really nice pictures of them?
Yes, of course. So this is our offering to you from all of us.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. And the Buddha accepts it. Look, there's the Buddha. I'm just, you know, it's like we have to think that it's like the Heart Sutra, and Lord Buddha is sitting up there in Rajagriha on Volta Peak, and he's sitting there and he's actually blissing out in meditation, just like my Buddha here. And then he's channeling his thoughts into the mouth of his disciples. So think of it like that. Buddha is just channeling his thoughts through me, and aren't you hearing this blah, blah out of my mouth? But actually think of it as Buddha's teachings. Then that's a really powerful way to do it, because then we get the blessing of Buddha's teachings. It's very skillful. So given that Buddha's going to give this teaching, let's make an offering to the Buddha as a request. So we have this Aquaman, and then we're going to visualize all the marvelous things in the universe. That's what a mandala is. A mandala is just this fancy Sanskrit word for your abode. You know, so all the Buddhas have their own abode, and we've got our abode. And of course, you know, it's beautiful, yes. So if we know Buddha's cosmology, and we know that the center of the universe is Mount Meru, and then we know that we're in the southern continent and our sky is blue, guess what? Because it's reflecting off lapis lazuli. I mean, you didn't learn that at school, did you? So we know the Buddha's cosmological universe, fantastic, we offer that. Otherwise, just think of all the gorgeous things that we use on this planet and pile them up. Don't hold back, think big, like Lama Yeshe said, and imagine as many of these marvelous things that you can, all the gorgeous objects of the senses that make people happy, you know, the food and the delicious things and the diamonds and the jewels and the lipstick and the handbags and the high heels and whatever gorgeous things make people happy. Pile them all up, and we offer them all to the Buddha as a request for the teachings. Okay, that's the plan. Saji perki jogshing metog tram ri rablingji ni de genpa di sange jingdu ni te ulwagi drokon nam dag jingla chapa shog. And as we say this little Sanskrit mantra, we imagine Buddha happily receives our offering. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. So now we set our motivation, like the lamas would say. But like what me might say is, let's state our purpose. Why are we here together for this 4 hours? You know, why? What's the point? Well, we're going to listen to Buddha's teachings. And that includes me, I promise. I am listening, definitely. So thank you for the opportunity for talking. So we're going to listen with what in mind, to listen for tools. This is the point, you know, it's not just interesting information, not just to fill our head with nice theories. It's to listen to it as advice. So of course you don't have to take the advice, because Buddha's not shoving it down our throats. It's just his suggestion. So we hear it as advice. And even if by the end of those 4 hours, you've got 1% that you'd like to put into practice, you go for it, because that's the bottom line, to put it into practice. So what's it for? Why? What's this advice for? two things to develop the two wings of the bird, okay? The first wing, the wisdom wing, is all the work we do on ourselves to turn ourselves into this outrageously marvelous person that Buddha says we can become, that we've got the potential for right now, you know, to develop that. And why? For our sake. But guess what? When you do that, you look around and you realize we're all in the same boat. Everyone's miserable. Everyone's looking for happiness. And they're looking in all the wrong places. So we think we've got to help them. How can we not? Can't leave them behind, you know? So it's the two wings of the bird. That's why we're listening, to get advice, help ourselves so we can help others. Thinking like that. Sanghe charang soke chognam la jangsho badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sanghe drupa shog. Sorry, the first two lines, that's the second two lines. The first two lines are for those of us who already figure we're Buddhists, and it's just reiterating our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings, you know. Sanghe charang soke chognam la jancho baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sanghe drupa shok. Sanghe charang soke chognam la jancho baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sanghe drupa shok. Hang on, gotta do something. Okay. All right. So I wonder where we left it last week. I don't know. We're talking about what we're talking, how to deal with uncertainty. Well, you know, I mean, yeah, there's 27 different doorways into this. We know that Buddhist view, this worldview, this vast worldview. What's that term in science? I always forget. They're looking for a view that explains everything. What is it? The view, what's it called?
Oh, the theory of everything.
Theory of everything. Well, listen, people, this is not being arrogant, but Buddhism is a theory of everything. You don't have to like it. You don't have to even want to think about it, but that's what it is. It's completely coherent, totally coherent, vast view of the universe. What it is, where it comes from, who we are, what the purpose of life is, how to get happy, and how to stop suffering, and how to get in touch with reality. That's not a joke to say that. I mean, scientists might think we're completely insane, these poor demented Buddhists, you know, but that's literally what it is. And you know, so, and to remember, what's the point of all this? Big picture, okay, what's the point? Well, you know, it's expressed perfectly. I'm sure I said it every week. I say it every week now all the time. But what's the point of all this? The big picture, the long-term result. This is almost so simple, it's embarrassing, but it really tells us exactly what the job of being a Buddhist is. Whether you're a 1% Buddhist or a 100% Buddhist, it's the same job. And it's expressed in the word Buddha. The etymology of this word is extremely delicious. And the Tibetan word, the Tibetan equivalent, is the same, Sangye, Buddha. Well, you know, Sang, Bud, implies the utter eradication from our mind, our consciousness, our very being, of all neuroses, all fear, all nonsense, all ego grasping, all the nonsense, the stuff that we are intimately familiar with, the stuff that we so take for granted as normal that we would think we'd, in our world, in our neuroscientific view of the universe and our view of the universe, psychologically speaking, to hear that what Buddha's saying is that you can get rid of this stuff, this is like mental illness. It's like weird for the world, but this is exactly what Buddha's saying. We can get rid of all the rubbish. It's not at the core of our being. It's adventitious. It is not intrinsic. It is not integral to who we are. This is an incredibly outrageous point, and this is unique to the Buddha's view of the mind. This is utterly unique. This is Buddhist psychology. It's outrageous. Not only can we do that, we get the second syllable, da, ge, implies we can develop literally to perfection all the other stuff in our mind that we are also familiar with. Love, wisdom, compassion, kindness, generosity, forgiveness, intelligence, self-confidence, you name it. So we know these words. We're intimately familiar with all the words I've just said. Love, hate, depression, anxiety, psychosis, mental illness, you name it. Compassion, generosity, we know all these words. This is the substance of Buddhist psychology. I mean, the West, we make it so complicated. There must be volumes of psychiatric, you know, illnesses, and every day we're discovering new ones. Buddha hasn't changed his view in 2,000 years, 2,500 years, you know. It's not a joke. It's almost deceptively simple. You know, it always seems simplistic. I mean, you don't go to the therapist, oh, I got angry today. Well, shut up, Rabina, and wait till you want to kill somebody. Come back to me then. No, not like that for the Buddha. So if this is the result of this hard work, it tells us the job. It tells us, it implies the methodology. So it's almost so simple. So what's the job? The bottom line of being a Buddhist, again, whether you're 1% or 100%, it's the same job. The bottom line, the essence, the heart job is distinguishing between the neuroses and the other stuff. That's it. If you can get rid of one lot and grow the other, if you can get rid of all the weeds and grow all the flowers in your garden, you had better learn botany, hadn't you? And what's your main job? To distinguish between the weeds and the flowers. That's it. Pull out the boring old weeds and grow the flowers. That's it. That's the bottom line. It's not a joke, you know, but it's kind of encouraging that it's that simple. But it's the hardest job we'll ever do. So it's because the concept is simple doesn't mean the job is simple. But don't lose track. Don't lose sight of the actual job. And that's what we tend to do. But it's not an easy job because that's not a job we do in our culture. We don't have that level of knowledge about our mind. And that's not insulting neuroscientists, not insulting, you know, psychologists and psychiatrists. But we know in terms of our views in this world, psychology is kind of the lowest on the totem pole because it's all about subjective and we don't trust subjective. But it's the exact opposite for the Buddha. The exact opposite, you know. These genius Indians, well before the Buddha, they're the ones who mapped the mind. They mapped the mind, not the brain. I remember the Dalai Lama so kindly gave $750,000 sometime to some bunch of neuroscientists to help them map the mind. I mean, how humble and kind of him. He's mapped it a long time ago. He doesn't need the map of the mind, but he's been encouraging because he's trying to bring the Buddhist views, which is so abstract to us in the West, you know, to bring it into this world so people can begin to listen to it by his listening to our views. He's so amazing, the Dalai Lama. These incredible conferences the last 30, 40 years, you know, mainly organized by an organization called Mind and Life. You'll see their website, mindandlife.org. They're amazing conferences the last 30, 40 years with the best brains in the West between His Holiness and his mob, you know, and the best brains in the West. And there's incredible findings coming out of this. It's just so encouraging. And I've met so many. I mean, we did a conference a bit like Tony Steele does in Sydney, you know, those happiness conferences. We did one in San Francisco 12 years ago. I remember we had people from all the big universities in America, and every one of those people had been moved and touched by working with His Holiness. It was extraordinary to hear them, you know. It's amazing. It's amazing. And of course, it's encouraging to hear, you know, neuroscientists now proving very kindly, very gently, politely proving what Buddha's been telling us for 2,500 years, very quietly. The difference is they're looking at it from the external point of view. Buddhism looks from the internal point of view. So the job of working on your mind and getting rid of the rubbish and growing the goodness, it sounds almost insanely simple, and it is. But to do it, why is it so hard? And this is what's so important. Why is it so hard? Well, let's take this view of, you know, what's it called again? A view of what? What's it called?
Theory of everything.
Let's take Buddha's theory of everything and look at it. There's two approaches that we need to use if we're trying to do even just the wisdom wing so that we can be qualified to do the compassion wing. And the wisdom wing is what we do on ourselves, the work we do, the nuts and bolts of Buddhist psychology and metaphysics and philosophy that we utilize and internalize in order to develop our own potential. And then we know how to help others, you know. So the two main things here, and this is the first stages of practice, the wisdom wing has to come first. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, you know, compassion is the point, but it's not enough. You've got to have wisdom. So if compassion is the university level, and if you take this lam rim packaging, if some of you might be familiar with this Tibetan packaging of all the Buddha's teachings, you know, I like to call it junior school, high school, university, and postgraduate. It's perfect. We get it. So junior school and high school is the wisdom wing. And you've got to go there first before you get anywhere near compassion wing, which is university level. And that's a big surprise to us. So I forget whatever we said last time, but let's just look into the wisdom wing, look into these nuts and bolts again, reminding us of how and why it's so hard to do this job, but then also how that qualifies us to be of benefit to others. It qualifies us for the compassion wing. In fact, the level of compassion the Buddha says we're capable of achieving is impossible without the wisdom wing. When we understand that, when we understand this gradual, you know, we hear it means, this lam rim means gradual path. It sounds very cute, but we don't kind of get it, you know? As much as we might've heard that all these years as Buddhists, it's a gradual path. But the moment you hear that, you know, as soon as we, you know, Lama Zopa, the way he's respecting the lineage would refer to what I call junior school, because we get that immediately. And it's just a cliche, but it's a really tasty one. Lama Zopa very respectfully calls it the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the least capability. Now, you wouldn't say that. What class are you in? Oh, I'm in the class that's suitable to the disciples of the least capability. People will laugh at you. That's junior school. Then middle scope, as we call them, the teachings of the middle scope, the student, the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the middle capability, that's high school. That's the wisdom wing. That's what you do to put yourself together. So, why is this job so difficult? Why is this job to get rid of the rubbish in the mind and to grow the goodness? Well, first of all, I suppose the first question should be, because this is not how we think of the world. We don't think, you know, okay, this is the method for getting happy, by the way. Another simple way of putting this is the method to get happy. Buddha says the method to get happy is give up delusions, and the method to get happy is to grow the virtues. But that's not what we think in our culture. We think to get happy, you've got to have a boyfriend or a cake or a happy feeling, you know, a nice taste or a good sound or something. Not for the Buddha. They're the secondary. So why is this job so difficult? Just to get happy and stop suffering? Because that's what the job is. In the end, you've achieved what the Buddha would say is the ultimate state of your own potential of perfect bliss and clarity and wisdom and compassion. Because that's your natural state. That's who we really are. We're not it yet, but that's our potential. That's what the Buddha, that's what means we all possess Buddha nature, you know, which is very encouraging to hear, especially when you're feeling completely suicidal and depressed and you can't see past your own nose. So why is this job so difficult? Because we are addicted to not doing it. We're addicted to all the opposite. So one simple way of presenting this job, Buddha says the way to get happy, is to give up delusions, give up attachment, give up anger, give up ego grasping, give up jealousy, give up depression, give up low self-esteem. I mean, the words are absurdly simple. But it's a surprise to us because we never thought that attachment and anger and low self-esteem are the cause of my suffering. We think they are my suffering, and we think they're the consequence of things that have happened to us. This is something that's so powerful. The thoughts, even if we've been practicing Buddhism for 30 years, it is still incredibly difficult to do it because we are addicted to not doing it. We're addicted not just to not doing it, but we're addicted to the opposite job. So since we were born, we know perfectly well. I mean, in my case, my mother didn't have to teach me to be angry. I knew it. I had it down. So we tend to think, oh, well, that's just the way Robina is, you know. She's angry because her father was angry or something. But, I mean, it's instinctive, virtually. And so what Buddha's telling us, and this is the karmic one, which is very unusual in the West. This is not a view of Christianity. It's not a view of Islam. It is a view of Hinduism, but they still posit a god, a creator. But it's not a view of materialism, absolutely not. But there's a similarity to materialism. You know, if a philosophical materialism, if I want to know what my problems are, I have to look back into the past, don't I? I go to my therapist and we look for a needle in a haystack and we go back to mummy and daddy and my genes and my DNA and then their behavior. And then we check out, where did this come from? We check back mummy's mummy and we go back to mummy's daddy's and daddy's mummy and daddy's grandmummy. And then we track back and go back to the monkeys. That's the evolutionary process that we follow with the Western materialist world, isn't it? So Buddha's exactly the same. He looks back into the past as well, but not your mummy's and daddy's past. This is the wackiest idea he's ever heard. No, he says, go back into your own past. And that's where the Buddha's got this unique approach. And it's called the law of karma. Did we talk about it last week, Miffy? I forget.
Yeah, we did. We got just into the beginning of karma and thought transformation. Okay. But I was wondering about, you know, just looking at the state of the world, how is that our karma?
Yeah, well, so we're going to go into this one now. This is the first, this is like, if you want to get, you know, one entry level junior school, grade one in Buddhist practice. The mind is the point. The end result of Buddhahood is your mind transformed. But from the beginning level of practice, he's not even concerned about the mind yet. He gets us to control the servants of our mind. And what are they? Our body and our speech. Our body and our speech. Now, why should we do that? I might have mentioned this last week, but it's a crucial point, and I say it all the time. And for us materialists, us Westerners, us Christians and Muslims or whatever Western, doesn't matter. But especially we've either got materialist view or we have got the view of Christianity or Islam, which is the creator. There's a really crucial point that's fundamentally different in Buddhism that we have to drill it into our brain, because once we get this point, we really can learn to understand karma properly. We can really learn to apply it in our daily life, and it'll be something really profound, not something scary. So our view of morality right now, our view of ethics, think about it. is it's doing what someone else said you're supposed to do. We have some vague notion, oh, it's good to be a nice person. But we don't really think beyond that. But generally, you know, if you're in my mother's household and she says, don't do that. Well, the first thing I'll say, being a smarty pants, is why not? And we know her answer, because I say so. And that's pretty powerful. So look at the world. You obey the traffic. You might have a sense of being respectful to other people on the road, but mainly you obey the traffic rules because you don't want to get arrested. You don't want to be fined, you know? I mean, in Australia, I can't believe it. I got so many fines. Just, you know, cameras are blinking at you everywhere. I could not, I mean, even though I just sped automatically, I gave up driving because I got so many speeding fines. So, you know, you don't speed because you don't want to get fined. You're a good girl because you don't want to get punished. So we have in our mind, in our brain drilled into us, and this is a misconception for the Buddha, we have the view of punishment and reward. It's very primordial. This is this dualistic view. And don't blame your Catholic mummy or your Jewish mummy for this. This is a function of ego grasping, Buddha says. This is one of the deepest consequences of this root delusion in our mind. That's the source of all our misery, you know, is we have that dualistic view. Now, I'm not being rude when I say it, but that is the view of having a creator, isn't it? And I'm not criticizing, actually. I mean, this is what I always quote this, and I'm sure I told you last week, and I say it every time. I asked my Jesuit priest friend, what, by definition, I wanted to know, I said, what is a sin by definition? What is a negative action, as Buddhism might refer to it? He said, by definition, a sin is doing what God said not to do. And why is that? Because God's the boss. We know that. Mummy's the boss. We know that. The police are the boss. The government's the boss. Someone out there's the boss. So, you know, so God is the boss. God, if there is a being who creates a universe, and Buddha would disagree with that, he's not being rude. He would disagree. We don't need creating, he says. We do fine creating our own mess. Our mind goes back and back. Am I going to go into this? But, you know, that we have that view. And if you have complete faith in God, God knows, God has got a plan. God knows what's going on because he made the place. He made me. He made the rules. So it is logical that you must do what God said. And that's what brings you close to God. And that's what happens if you die, you do God's will, you go to heaven and you're oneness with God. I'm not complaining about that concept. It sounds pretty nice. And if you don't, you separate yourself from God and then you suffer. So that's like, that's the view. We call that punishment and reward. So by definition, this Jesuit priest said, a sin is doing what God said not to do, going against God's will. This is powerful. Now, because we know that, and we have it in our bones, this punishment reward mentality, we have that in our mind already. So then naturally, when we hear Buddhism say, just like Jesus, don't, there's a list of 10 things. Jesus got a list of 10 things as well. A bit different. One of them is don't kill. Well, Jesus says that too. And then so naturally we think that Buddha's reason is the same as Jesus, because God said, no. Buddha doesn't talk like that. Buddha's more like, and this is, so the crucial point about karma for Buddha, first of all, it's this, talk about worldview, a view that explains everything. This is a huge view. It's vast in the literature. It's coming from these Indians well before the Buddha. They observed it in the subtlety of their own mind in concentration meditation. This natural law, it's a natural law. There's no equivalent in Buddhism in terms of the world, the universe, called Buddha's law. There are Buddha's rules, yeah, within a household, you know, if you're living together as monks and nuns, he's got a list of vows, don't do this and don't do that, like mummy has. But in terms of the universe and how it functions, there's no view like that in Buddhism. There's no such thing as a creator. He's not being rude if you have faith in a creator, you know. His view is we don't need creating because our consciousness goes back and back and back and back and back. And we create our own stuff. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has referred to the law of karma like self-creation. So what is it? To really be a Buddhist, I mean, many people who are Buddhists in the world have no interest in karma. Don't talk about it, don't know about it. I remember a Zen monk one way, I'm not criticizing, it's just how it is. One Zen monk I met years ago, and I asked him about what it is. He had no idea that they don't think about it. That's okay, people can take 1% of Buddhism and practice it, but we're talking the big picture here. So the law of karma is fundamental to understanding the entire Buddha's worldview. If you know, it's fundamental, and it's completely based on understanding what the mind is, because it's the mind that runs within the law of karma. The law of karma, this natural law, runs the universe in the same way that the law of botany runs gardens. Gardens exist within the law of botany. So minds and lives of all sentient beings run within this natural law. No, Buddha is not a creator. He did not make it up. He is not speculating. It is not coming from revelation. It is not made up. He didn't have a vision of it. He didn't have a dream of it. There's no concept like that in Buddhism. Sure, there are advanced teachings when Buddha at a more subtle level can teach people in their subtle meditation. That's another discussion. But there's no law, there's nothing like that. And that's why I always quote that one time in New Zealand years ago in Nelson, one scientist, in fact, he was a scientist, asked me the question, who revealed the teachings to the Buddha? And he was shocked and people all laughed when I said, don't be ridiculous. Would you ask Einstein who revealed the teachings about relativity to him? Of course you would not, because we know immediately we hear that fancy word, that Greek word. All our fancy words are always in Greek, aren't they? We don't think about the Indians, do we? We love to go back to the Greeks, don't we? So science, it means you're using your noggin. You're looking at what's real. You're not just believing in nonsense. Well, Buddha agrees. That's his method. It just happens to be he asserts subtler levels of consciousness that can see things that are more subtle, like the past and the future. And that's where Buddha's view is coming from. So this teaching of karma is this natural law that minds and lives of all beings run within. And the thing that the main part of us that creates karma is the mind, consciousness, our thoughts and feelings and emotions, this super subjective experiential part of us, which depends upon a decent brain, obviously depends upon a decent body and nervous system, but is not itself a function of the brain. Absolutely clear. The brain, you could argue, you know, a way of putting it, not without insulting neuroscientists and all their hard work. A brain is a physical indicator of what goes on in the mind. I'd say it that way, you know, and only the gross level anyway. So this law of karma that runs the universe, or within which we run, it, you know, one way of framing all of it is in terms of happiness and suffering. And this is one way of framing the entirety of Buddhism. It's a method for how to get happy and how to stop suffering. It's a way of saying it. Another way of presenting Buddhism is a method of living in good ethics. Another way of presenting Buddhism, and this is a crucial one, is a method of how to stop being ignorant and how to get happy, how to get wisdom. We're not sure if we want wisdom, but we know we want happiness. Well, you know what, folks? The method to get happiness is to get wisdom. That's how you get happiness. That's the point the Buddha's making. So this big picture. So the Buddha's telling us that right now we are living in la-la land. That's what he means by being in samsara. There's two different ways of using that word, you know. One way is being caught up in our own mind in these neuroses and delusions and misconceptions about reality, about ourselves and about happiness and suffering and whose problem it is and blah, blah. We have all these misconceptions. Quite literally, he says our mind is riddled with layers of misconceptions. And he's not being arrogant. You don't have to believe him. He's just telling us what he's observed. It's up to us to prove him to be true, you know. He's allowed to tell us what's right. Everyone's allowed to tell you what's right. They just then present their methodology, then it's over to you. So he's telling us that being in samsara, either it's referring to this, to going from life to life, which is what he says happens to this mind of ours, because the law of karma would say that this mind of ours, this non-physical capacity for cognition, is whatever every millisecond of what we think and do and say programs us. So seeds in our mind, nothing goes astray. We are our own creator, quite literally. Everything we think and do and say produces the person we become. Whatever we think and do and say produces the person we become. This is something really simple, but we understand it when it comes to being a mathematician. We understand it when it comes to being a scientist, a doctor, a cook. You produce the cook by getting your concepts right, learning all the theories, and then experientially putting them into practice. We get that. You produce the cook. You produce, well, the Buddha says we produce the person, the happy person, the suffering person, the crazy person. That's the fruit of our past actions. It's hardly rocket science. So we just have to posit the possibility that a mind does not come from God, a creator, no concept like that. It does not come from mummy and daddy. For the Buddha's view, consciousness, thoughts and feelings and emotions and tendencies coming from someone else is a very weird idea. The more you take on board the Buddha's view, the more it causes us to take responsibility for whatever arises in our mind, because it's the fruit of what I have done before. Just like that music, just like that cooking, just like that math. This is the point. So our consciousness, Buddha says, it doesn't come from mummy, daddy. It is not a function of the physical. It does not come from a creator. Don't need that. It comes from a previous moment of itself. So there's one very practical way approach to this. One time Dalai Lama was asked, how do you prove reincarnation? He said, it's not difficult at all. First, you posit the possibility that consciousness is not physical. And then you have to look at the cause of something. So this law of cause and effect, which is exactly how Buddha sees the universe. If you look into, you know, a cake, you have to, you see the cake fully made. So what is the cause of that? Well, the substantial cause of that cake is all the components in it. They call it a substantial cause. It's the stuff, the flour, the chocolate, the butter, the milk, the eggs, all the stuff mixed together. They are the cause. If you deconstructed the cake and went backwards, in time, you'd end up back with the various different components, all separate. And then what's the cause of that flour? You go back to the previous moment of the flour, and you can track that, and you keep going. And this is the Buddhist view. If you keep going, you track that flour back. That moment of flour came from this, which came from that, which came from this, which came from that. And you get back a year ago, and you keep saying all that. And you follow the continuity of that stuff called flour. You won't suddenly find a spot where there was nothing and it popped up into view like a magic wand. That's ridiculous. And you would never get it back to a creator. You'd get back to the first moment of this universe. Big bang. And then as His Holiness says, big bang, no problem. Just not the first big bang, that's all. You'd have to keep tracking it back. In fact, the Buddha's view is the universe is made of the four elements, the matter is made of four elements, and then there are minds. And both of them are beginningless, as nutty as that sounds to us. But it's the only logical conclusion if you posit the law of cause and effect. This comes from this. Where did this come from? That. Where did that come from? This. It's the chicken and the egg, So it's a very powerful concept just to think about intellectually, because we're all convinced. If you keep looking back like a needle in a haystack, you'll find it. Ha ha, there's the first cause. We want a first cause. Well, that's a non-question for the Buddha. It's a nutty question. It's an illogical question. Because how in the name of heaven can you find a first something that didn't come from something before it? You can't. Even conceptually, this makes sense. So logically, then the Buddha would say matter, the four elements are beginningless. The mind is beginningless. This planet we live on is a blip in the ocean. We've had countless past lives. I mean, this is a demented idea for us. So this is the Buddha's view. So now what's the implication of this? This is the point now. What's the implication of this experientially? This is the point. Once we get this, this begins to transform us. Once we get this, we stop being a victim. We stop blaming. We stop feeling guilty. We stop feeling neurotic. We start to take responsibility. We start to own what ourself. We are the product of our own hard work, rubbish work or good work. Either way. So, if everything we think and do and say sow seeds in the mind or produce a future experiences, the next level of detail in the law of karma is that everything we do that's negative will produce a suffering, and everything we think we do that's positive will cause happiness. So, of course, we have to get Buddha's definition of what is negative, what is positive. This is very clear. We have to get his definition. Well, right back at the very beginning, junior school, entry level, grade one, Buddha exhorts us first, please, people, at least don't kill, at least don't steal, at least don't badmouth, at least don't jump on the wrong partner. It's a half a dozen things, seven little things of the body and speech. So then you have to ask him, Buddha, why are you suggesting I don't kill? And that's the right question. So if it's Jesus you're asking, and I'm not complaining, it's because God said, good enough. That's a powerful reason to live your life. But it's not the Buddha's, that's all. So Buddha's answer is two parts. Well, first he says, actions that are called negative, heavy-duty ones, extra ones, are the ones that harm others. Open your eyes and check it out. Ask people around, do you like being killed? Do you like being bad-mouthed? Do you like being punched in the nose? Everyone will say no, and you can deduce by the monkey's behavior and the ant's behavior, they don't like it either. So we can deduce that, guess what? People don't like getting harmed, and I mean duh. Well, that's called a negative action. That's a heavy-duty negative action. But you know what? That means that they're suffering, but that is not his first reason for exhorting us not to do it. He says, you've got to first realize you're being a baby, that everything you think and do and say, when this is the principle of the law of karma, this is the creative principle in Buddhism, this is the self-creation, that every millisecond of what I do in my mind and then my body and speech, necessarily none of it goes astray. It's all part of the process of creating karma, action it means. And it sows seeds, those actions sow seeds in my mind. And then seeds will not go astray, and they eventually will ripen in two ways. One as suffering, or two as happiness. Actually, there's a third category called neutral. Who cares about them? Don't worry about them for now. There are either happy experiences or suffering experiences. Now, before we go to further, check your life. Since you can remember, I guarantee if you started dividing up into categories of happiness and suffering, you'd include all your experiences. You'd have a whole bunch that you call happy, and there's a spectrum from mildly happy to the most divinely happy. And then there are those that are called suffering. Again, minor ones to the major. This is our life. Analyze it. Now look at what we want. Look at what drives us. And this is where we have to understand the mind. There's two different whole bodies of knowledge, the knowledge about karma and then the knowledge about the mind. you know, and they're utterly integrated because the mind creates karma. So understanding the mind, like we talked, I think, last week about the components in our mind, the delusions, the anger, the fears, the jealousy, all rooted in ego grasping, then the love, the compassion, the kindness, the generosity that are not rooted in, you know, in delusions. These are the components of our mind. So if we understand then karma, a negative action, which is one that will produce my suffering, it'll produce, it sows seeds in my mind that will ripen as my suffering. So when it comes to lots of things in our life, we get this. You go to your doctor and she's, and you're feeling sick. What's the problem? And she analyzes and she checks that you're getting diabetes. Why? Because you're eating too much sugar. So, you know, you hear that and it's a revelation to you. Thank you so much. You're so grateful to your doctor to point out what you've been doing wrong that is now causing you sickness and will cause you more sickness if you don't stop. So you don't go, oh, you mean you're going to punish me with diabetes? You mean you're telling me, why shouldn't I eat sugar? Because I say so. No, tell the doctor to go to hell. That's not the reason she's telling you. She's a wise person who knows the health, and she's observed that by eating sugar, you'll get diabetes. Well, Buddha's like that. So the real reason, the first reason he's telling us not to kill, exhorting us, suggesting, advice, it's just advice, is because guess what, Rabina, precious girl, by doing an action that harms another, because that's an action you do with your body or your speech, and because it's driven by a delusion, that's why you harm others, then that will cause you for future suffering because you're sowing those seeds in your mind. And so he exhorts us first to pull out the weeds, not even pull out the weeds, to stop putting in more weeds. That's his first level of practice. At least stop sowing more weeds. At least stop planting more weeds. Stop doing actions that will ripen in the future as you're suffering. And the reason is because it'll harm you. And this is something in our culture we do not like to hear. It sounds to us so selfish. Oh, I can't think that way. Surely it's best not to, is to be a good girl because I want to help others. Yeah, when you get to university, folks, you've got to understand your own suffering. You've got to have your hands, like one of my friends said, I'm not allowed to swear, but I'll spell it out. One of my therapist Buddhist friends said, being a practitioner is having your hands in your own shit. That's what you have to learn to do, to realize that you are causing your own suffering. This is a powerful concept. And when, of course, you realize that, you can realize you're causing your own happiness, and that gives us courage. So the fundamental law of karma is everything any sentient being thinks or does or says cannot go astray. It just necessarily programs your mind, and negative actions will produce future suffering. So what is a negative action? Well, just to keep it simple, at least we prevent ourselves from doing the heaviest ones, the ones that harm others. Killing, taking the ungiven, as the Tibetans put it, as Lama Zopa translates, stealing, jumping on the wrong partner, or raping. You know, don't misuse your body. And what are those actions? What, and this is the point, what drives us to do those actions? And that's what we have to unpack. So what is it? When we do an action, what action? Karma means action, actually. And the main driver of that is the mind. So when you do an action, let's say of a virtuous action of non-killing, a proactive, intentional, it has to be a proactive, intentional action that drops a seed into your mind stream, and then that will multiply and manifest as future happiness. So there's four ways that our present actions will ripen in the future. But if you look at your life now, which is the future of the past, look at your life now, and you can divide your life into four categories. The entirety of your life can be divided into these four ways, the four results of your past actions. So we've got four ways our karma ripens. One is the type of rebirth. So we've got human. It's like we won the lottery. This is the fruit of conscious, intentional non-killing in our little bank vault. Got these bank vaults with millions of seeds in them. So we've packed our bank vault with delicious, intentional, virtuous actions of conscious, intentional non-killing. This is the cause of getting a human body, of our mind running like a magnet to our present mummy's human womb when she hopped into bed with our daddy, which was the condition. They didn't create you. They're happily, they're doing their thing, and we come barging in, you know, because we've got some karmic history with those two people. And the karmic seed that caused that was triggered a few weeks before that, while you were still in a previous body, at the time you were dying. It's quite precise. In Lama Zabramche's book that came out a few years ago, but now is again as a paperback, I hope it's in Australia soon, it's called How to Face Death Without Fear. And it's got great detail about how to help your loved ones, but particularly, of course, how to help yourself to be ready for death. Because the time of death, before you stop breathing, and that's whether it's for your cat, for your grandma, for your baby, or yourself, before you stop breathing in the death process, about the time before you stop breathing, you know, is when the karmic seed in your bank vault was in past life of a virtuous bank, a virtuous karmic seed, which was triggered, that already programmed you before you even stopped breathing to go to the present mother's human womb. It had nothing, it had a lot to do with them, because you've got some karmic history with them, we'll discuss that, but you, they didn't make you. They're just the condition. They hopped into bed and had sex, which is what people do. Now they use petri dishes and things, and their consciousness joins that egg and sperm. That's it. You caused that, honey. So there's like a miracle. The first type of, the result of a rebirth is a human one, which is the result of a good action, particularly non-killing. Why? Because killing is the heaviest. Second, the way your karma ripens, the second track of karma, the second lot of bank vault seeds that were triggered at the time you passed away, was your tendencies, your mental, your tendencies, your personality traits, your characteristics. So you've got your Mother Teresa and you've got your Hitler, haven't you? And we're somewhere in between there. So we can see clearly they both had the first kind of karma. They both got a human rebirth from one track of karma. We've got millions of karmic seeds. The second lot, clearly they're very different. Have a look at old Hitler, Mr. Hitler's maniac tendencies. And look at kind Mummy Teresa, you know, Mother Teresa. So they've got different tendencies. Three, and that the first one's called the fully ripened result. The second one is called your tendencies, or your tendencies similar to the cause. Guess what? From having done them before. So whether you're born as a Hitler person, whether you're born as a psychopath, whether you're born with a tendency to be loving or kind, whether you want tendency to be a fisherman, whether you have a tendency to play the piano. I mean, I'm watching these days these ingenious little 5-year-olds, 3-year-olds and 6-year-olds play Bach and Chopin and Mozart. I mean, I'm captivated by them, you know. This one little blonde Russian boy, he just blows my mind. Since he's 3, he's been playing Bach, you know. He's got a website. It's incredible. I can't believe it. You can't believe your eyes. Well, it's the same reasoning why some other little child, I remember one serial killer, American serial killer, Jeffrey Dahmer. I mean, old people like me might remember him. He was well known in America. He killed many people and ate their brains and stuck them in the fridge and God knows what. We just think he's a monster and he should go to hell. But, you know, we want to look at karma, the reason about karma. He, since a tiny boy, no one taught that little boy how to play piano. He just had to pick up a music and off he went. No one taught me how to be angry. I knew. No one taught my friend, you know, Day Chen in Queensland. I always quote this, you know, Day Chen, a friend of ours, when her son was like 3, she was taking the lice out of his head and he was in tears of compassion. Mummy, mummy, don't hurt them. Leave them alone. And all he wanted to do was just leave the little lice there because he had compassion. She hadn't had time to teach him that. He was 3, for God's sake. So we come with our tendencies. And he's 40-something now and he's never killed a living thing, you know. So we have our own tendencies. They're our tendencies. Mummy and Daddy might share them, but they did not give them to us. That's a crucial point that Buddha makes. So the first way our karma ripens, and that's our human body in our case. The second is the tendencies within this person, within our mind. They're our tendencies, our habits. Third is called experiences similar to the cause. Now you check your life. Since you were born up to now, since you were conceived up to now, you have relied upon and you have relationships with beings, with your mummy and your daddy and your sisters and your uncle and your auntie and the cockroaches and the rats in your house and the mosquitoes or whoever it is, or the cane toads if you live in Queensland. You know, we've got all these sentient beings that occupy our lives. We're very social beings. And you check this. Since you can remember, if you checked all your experiences in relation to sentient beings, you could divide those sentient beings into 2 categories, those who are kind to you and those who are mean to you. And yeah, we know they swap roles. But in the end, you can look at all the beings who have been good to you, who believe your words, who love you, who nurture you, who take care of you. And then there are those who are mean to you, who lie to you, who steal from you, who rape you, who don't like you, who don't believe your words. We know this. This is a major way of our lives. We're such social beings. All these sentient beings are not random events. This can't be. If karma is a natural law, how can it be random? No law that's reasonable, that's a valid law, is not random. It's just a question of learning it. So there's no sentient being we meet whom we haven't met before. There's no sentient being who harmed us whom we haven't harmed before. There's no sentient being who's good to us who hasn't been kind to us before, you know. This is a very weird idea for the West. It's a very weird idea for Christians. It's completely, and they're the 2 main views of the world, aren't they? You track yourself back to God or you track yourself back to mummy and daddy. Not for the Buddha, neither. The body, yeah, no problem. They gave us a body. They're very kind. So the fourth way our karma ripens, even more abstract, is the way the very physical world impacts upon us. Now, straight away, this gets us to what we're experiencing now, you know. So we experience karma individually, And we also experience as groups. And why do we? Because guess what? We do things in groups. So obviously we're going to experience them in groups. The Nazis were a group. The Jews and whoever else it was in Germany who suffered at the hands of the Nazis, they were groups. People who now who suffer are groups. People who get good things happen are groups. You know, we're all groups. We do things in groups and we experience the result in groups.
Venerable Rubino, is the COVID the result of negative actions?
I'm about to talk about Miffy. Give me a break. She's got her wonderful questions. I'm leading to it. I'm getting there as quick as I can without missing important pieces. Thank you, Miffy. She's the best questioner on the planet. She keeps me on track. I'm just about there, practically. Okay, but I like talking about the good things first because we only think about karma when it comes to the bad things. We're addicted to misery. As I always quote, I've never yet in my centuries of being a Buddhist ever had a person ask the question, Rubina, why do good things happen? No one ever asked that. But let's look at the bad things. So right now, so there's four ways our karma ripens. One is the type of body. Two is your mind. Three, your experiences at the hands of others. And four, the way the physical world impacts upon you. So let's take, for example, let's take one virtuous action of non-killing. As an example, the first way that would ripen, if it were triggered at the time before you die, and that programs you, in our case, we got that, human birth is the result of one of those. So humans, you might go, well, what's good about humans? I mean, look at us, we're a bunch of peanuts. We are, but it's the best of a bad lot. At least if we're fortunate, we have access to some of our virtues and our intelligence. That's at least the one saving grace that we've got as a human, you know? So the second result of non-killing, like that little boy, like Day Chen's son, you'd wake up in this life with no thought to kill. I mean, it's not random. This is the fruit of his living in vows of non-killing. And I'm going to get into vows. It's so powerful. So the second result of non-killing is you don't have a tendency to kill. Many of us maybe started killing when we were little and then we became Buddhist or we just decided, some people, and we decided we would not kill. So those of us who are Buddhist, we've got a vow not to kill any living being, even the mosquitoes, you know, do our best. We'll discuss all this. The third result of non-killing, guess what? And we've got that one so far. That's the experiences similar to the cause. That is, you don't get killed and you don't die young. Look at us so far. We're not dead yet. Our petrol tank of non-killing in terms of it's being an experience hasn't run out yet. Now, flip that over. Now, do the fourth one first, and then we'll discuss COVID. So the fourth one, environmental karma, is, and this is abstract for us. It's quite hard to hear this initially, but I can explain it later. We'll go into it just roughly how it works according to the Buddhist model of the mind and the view of the universe. So the fourth one is called environmental karma. It's the very way the physical world impacts upon us. Now, what does the physical world mean? You're living in, you know, you're living in Brisbane and you're in an old people's home and suddenly some people start getting COVID-19, right? So those people might not be your aunties, or your uncles, or your beloved sisters, but they're your environment. It's like, you know, I always joke about the cane toads in Queensland. Those Americans who've never heard of cane toads, they got them into Australia at some point to I don't know, what was the reason for a cane toad? What was the obstacle in the sugar fields?
Just to kill some bugs in the sugar field.
Some bugs. So clever humans brought in this guy called a cane toad, and so now it's become a pest, and Queenslanders love to drive over them because they're so hideous that any animal who eats a cane toad dies an agonizing death. So they loathe cane toads. So from the point of view of, you know, you might die young as a result of, say, you know, and the animal dies young. That's the experience similar to the cause of killing. But the fourth one is environmental karma. So in us with COVID-19, look at it. You might be having COVID. That's the fruit of your past killing, which is ripening as an experience similar to the cause of your past killing. If you don't have COVID-19, that's the result of your non-killing. But, you know, we only tend to think there are causes of the bad things. We never tend to think there are causes of the good things. But it's got to be both. Botany refers to the flowers and the herbs, the flowers and the weeds, okay? You can't just say, how dare there be weeds in my garden? Who put them there? And then take the flowers for granted. They both are run by the law of botany. Well, happiness and suffering is the same. So COVID-19 right now, have a look. It's a worldwide illness. So for many of us, it is environmental karma that just by touching another human being, you can die. I mean, that is intense. It's like eating a cane toad. That's environmental karma of killing. But if you personally get, you know, if you also die young, that's the second one as well, the experience similar to the cause. So The result of non-killing, you get a human body, you don't have any tendency to kill, you don't die young, you don't get sick, you don't get killed, and you don't get sick. The fourth one, environmental. But look at the world now. So it's collective karma. You can have environmental karma of killing if you, let's say, will die if you eat a peanut. All your friends are eating peanuts and they're getting healthy, but you die. So it's an individual getting the result of their past killing. But if you're, like right now, COVID-19 is pervading the whole world. It's an environmental karma of millions of people. And this is the fruit of killing. And environmental karma takes the longest to ripen. It could be from 1,000 lifetimes ago, you know. So roughly speaking, this is the explanation, as far as Buddha's concerned, of why bad things happen. But it's also the explanation of why good things happen. But of course, we can't help but hear it when it's the bad things. The first thing we say is, oh, you mean I'm the blame? You mean I'm a bad person? It is devastating for us to hear this because we hear it in terms of punishment and reward. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, no, when you go to the doctor, you don't have devastating guilt because you didn't know that sugar would give you diabetes. Now you're so happy the doctor's telling you the solution, stop eating sugar. You don't feel guilty. You feel it's a revelation. Now you know the problem. You don't blame, you can blame the sugar company if you like. People still smoke cigarettes through their throat and a hole in their throat while they continue to sue Marlboro. You can sue Marlboro if you like, but kind of take responsibility and stop the smoking, please, you know. So karma is Buddha's explanation of the universe, and every sentient being, and humans are like a tiny percentage of all sentient beings. What about all the monkeys, the dogs, the fish? They're all mind possessors. They're all sentient beings, and they're all being run by this law. There's no one pulling the strings. It's not punishment. It's not reward, because there's no punisher and there's no rewarder. This really does take us time to hear, but this is the fundamental law in the whole of Buddhism. And then by knowing the mind, learning Buddhist psychology, you become intimately familiar with these different states. So first you control the body and speech, which calms your karma down. At least you control the servants of your mind first, junior school. Don't kill, don't steal, don't lie. And why? Because you don't want the future suffering. You've got to get that. You've got to have this kind of compassion for yourself, that I am sick of suffering, so I'm going to stop causing suffering. That's the approach with karma. And it really, for us, takes time. We hear it as guilt. We hear it as bad. We hear it as shame. We hear it as blame. We hear it as punishment. But that's our, we make that. Buddha's not saying that. We hear it like that. And that's the big problem, you know. So now with that little bit of introduction.
So, Venerable Rabina, there's a couple of questions about this collective karmic experience.
Yeah.
One from Kate about asking, is COVID the result of the negative actions of so many beings in our world?
Yeah,
so
right.
How do we figure it out? Is it the result of our actions, even though we're not sick? Or
okay, now that's good. Thank you. So first of all, here we are. Let's say we haven't got COVID-19, but so that means we personally haven't got the third kind of karma, which is the experience similar to the cause of. Which, in case you die, we haven't got that one yet. But second, being sick in general is the fourth kind, is environmental karma. So we haven't got that one either, but we have got some karmic result, isn't it? Your beloveds might die. You know, your next door neighbors, you can't go to work. So you're, even though having no money and losing your job is not a result of killing at all, but it is another consequence of this disease, isn't it? So we are all suffering in one way or another. Look at the anxiety people are having. Look at the number of people who are homeless. I mean, in America, they're going to have millions of people because they're not trying to give them any money. They're going to be millions of people homeless because they can't pay their rent, for God's sake. I mean, I know some countries are even trying to pay people's rent, or he's putting a moratorium on paying rent. I mean, so all of those are consequences, not of killing, though. The person who has COVID-19, that's a result of killing. But the consequences of it touching the whole world is your poverty. That's the fruit of, now, if you lose your job and you have poor, that's the fruit of your stealing. So what, try to get it this way, whatever the experience is, label it. I'm poor, I haven't got any money. I wonder what that causes. That's lack of generosity or because of stealing. I'm losing my job. I'm being accused by somebody. You know, I can't, I mean, anything that happens, it's, you look at the action, that's called the experience similar to the cause, and an action like that was the cause of that for you. So COVID-19 is not your problem, but it's in the environment around you. You've got to be cautious, you've got to be careful, you've got to wear masks, you can't kiss your mother, you can't sleep with your boyfriend. So all this suffering, but they're individual experiences, and each of them is a particular experience as a result of a particular action of yours. So we've got to really nut it out, you know. Every second we're experiencing something. Every second we're thinking something. Every second something is happening to us. So this is like a big garden of things. Each of them is the fruit of a particular seed. Every single tiny experience you have is the fruit of a particular seed. And those you call happy are the fruit of a virtuous seed. And those that are called suffering are the fruit of a non-virtuous one. This is, it's kind of a pretty straightforward explanation. It's just because it's brand new to us, we can't get our head around it, you know? What other questions?
So then, Venerable, from Maria's, a little bit more on the positive side of things. So yes. When we're looking at our own fortunate results, how do we distinguish between it being like an echo from a previous life, like a karmic result, or just being wishful thinking, you know, just being in delusional that we're just fine and everything's going along okay?
Well, Maris, no, the second one is just not being, it's like looking at a garden that's full of weeds, but because you can't be bothered and because you don't know botany, you think, oh, it's good enough. Well, you haven't analyzed it enough. You start to analyze everything, then you've got to be very precise and you've got to look at each moment. You've got to look at each thing in that garden. You've got to start, you learn botany. Well, I mean, actually that's a weed and that's a flower and that's a herb. And if I put that one there, that's going to suffocate this one. So you've got to get into the details, Marius. We don't normally do this. So with karma, it's the same. As we become more sophisticated in our practice and more precise and more logical, and we know, learn this law more, we'll be able to look at each moment of our experience and we'll know exactly what caused it. I mean, we've got to have that because we're the one who did it. It's not secret. It's not held in, it's not somebody up in the sky with his plan in his pocket. We have to learn this plan because we did the suffering and we did the happiness. So we're just wishful thinking, oh, everything's good enough. It's just being lazy. No, you've got to analyze what your suffering is. And Buddha's view of suffering goes to much subtler levels than we can imagine, Marius, you know. In fact, when we look at the Four Noble Truths for a moment, in a minute, we'll do that. There are three levels of suffering. We'll go into this, and so we'll be looking into the mind in more detail. We'll just stick to karma now. What other questions?
There is a question about the nature of the mind from Wolfgang. So that if you bring, say, 1,000 parts of a motorbike together, like magic, suddenly it generates, you know, movement and is useful. So why is it not possible to bring a million body parts together and generate consciousness? So it's like, what would the Buddha say about Frankenstein, basically?
Well, right, it's very easy, Wolfgang. It's really simple. We have to take the starting point, the hypothesis we have to take from the beginning with this discussion is that consciousness in its nature is not physical. So you can have embody in its nature is not the mind. So body and mind are separate separate entities. They have an intimate, inextricable relationship, actually. But they're absolute, and this is a fundamental starting point, Wolfgang, for the entirety of Buddhism. So, you know, this is why, you know, artificial intelligence is the most stunning thing, but there's never in a million years can you ever create a consciousness. If we take the view that Wolfgang's consciousness is all your thoughts, feelings, emotions, unconscious, subconscious, instinct, intuition, the entire spectrum of your inner being. So posit that and then know that it is linked to Wolfgang's body. It has absolutely got body and mind. They're inextricably linked together, but they're separate entities. So if you take that view, the substantial cause of this moment of your anger, substantial cause of something is the stuff that it's made of. So the substantial cause of this plastic, whatever plastic is, don't ask me, but we know that the stuff that it's made of, and you can track that back. So the substantial cause of your consciousness in general, or your particular moment of anger or moment of intelligence, the substantial cause is the previous millisecond of that cognition. And the substantial cause of that moment of cognition is the previous moment of cognition. And you track that back, Wolfgang, to beginningless time, because you will never find a first moment, because it can't be such a one, because it's cause and effect. So the substantial cause of something is it's the stuff that it's made of. And mind is not physical. You can't see it, taste it, touch it, smell it, cut it into pieces. You cannot. It is not physical. So you can have 40 billion robots looking like humans, smelling like humans, touching like humans, feeling like humans, but they will. That's just physical matter. Now, who knows if not one day, due to the karma we're creating, that a thing called a physical, you know, maybe a stuff that's made of whatever we make up a robot out of, maybe one day consciousnesses will die from being in Wolfgang's body, and due to past karma, because you're so attached to AI or something, then your mind might even go and join that robot's body. That's a different discussion. But you cannot make a mind. You can make a physical body because we're so clever, but you can't make a mind. This is fundamental, Wolfgang.
So in this analogy, Venerable, of the 1,000 parts of a motorbike and putting them together, I mean, one part of the analogy is you could just put them all in a box, but you don't get a motorbike. The only way you get a motorbike is actually with intention, isn't it?
So, yes. So then what's the point there?
So the point of putting all the parts together, for instance, of a body or an AI, then theoretically, would it be possible then for a mind to have the intention to inhabit it?
Well, that's what I said before. I said, I'm just speculating that due to past karma and past habit and past attachment and these views that we're creating, because everything we think and do and say will produce future things. So if this conviction of our mind in terms of the physical scientific world, that by creating with artificial intelligence, you create a physical thing that replicates the behavior of a human, it isn't a human. It's just, I mean, as soon as you pull the electric plug, it's a piece of metal, isn't it? I mean, it's not a human, but I wouldn't be, maybe I'm speculating that due to strong karma and strong attachment, we might one day, let's say pretend Wolfgang's an AI guy and he's completely convinced that he can create another human. Maybe due to his attachment, his mind might run to a robot and it might even occupy it. Maybe that's a possibility. Except, of course, as we know from the Vajrayana mythi, you've got to have the subtle nervous system and the winds and the drops and all that stuff. So that's probably not possible. But minds can be everywhere. Minds can inhabit, you know, inhabit computers and wood and trees and everything. It doesn't mean that become, but there's a difference. It doesn't mean it become the body. So the body, see, the body and the mind in the Vajrayana system, Wolfgang, when you start to study that, that'll really give the explanation of how the AI thing just doesn't work, you know, because there are subtler levels of consciousness and very subtle levels of consciousness. And these are the fundamental building blocks of a consciousness that are inextricably linked to a subtler level of physical energy called the wind energy and the different parts. From that perspective, it wouldn't be possible to create, that you can't create another mind. That's why the idea of a creator for the Buddha is a very weird idea. It's not being rude to Christians. It's just very strange. Wait a minute. Also to Wolfgang, when you're really advanced, Wolfgang, when you're a bodhisattva and you've given up delusions, you've realized emptiness, you've got bodhicitta, the lowest level bodhisattva, and there are 10 stages of your development to become Buddha, you have the capability, Wolfgang, to manifest your mind as anything you like. You could manifest as a tree, as a computer, as a lamp, as a robot. You could do that, but that will be a conscious, intentional action of a bodhisattva to do that to help sentient beings. But another person outside can't make a mind. It's impossible. But that physical energy can be occupied by a mind, by a bodhisattva's mind, who's capable. They can manifest their mind in 100 different forms simultaneously, and a Buddha can do what they like. They can make universes. But this is where the big difference between the Christian view and this view. The Christian view says there's a superior being who makes me. But the Buddha would say, you know, okay, I'll tell a nice story about the Dalai Lama. It's a lovely story, this story. The Dalai Lama is said to be the Buddha. That means he's fully, okay, what does that mean? Rid of all the rubbish and full of the goodness. That sounds pretty simple. But let me tell you more of how he would be if he's a Buddha. And this is what our potential is, okay? His mind, a Buddha's mind, once you've completely rid all the rubbish, this consciousness, which is not physical, necessarily pervades wherever there is existence. Now, I remember as a Christian, as a little girl, as a Catholic, I loved the idea of God is everywhere. I'd think and think about God is everywhere. I loved it though. I don't know what it meant. Well, this is exactly right. When we are fully developed as a Buddha, Wolfgang, when you become a Buddha, your mind, your consciousness pervades wherever there is existence. Think about this, because it's no longer encumbered by all the delusions. You've completely freed your consciousness. It pervades the universe. One. Two, it has infinite wisdom such that it can see the minds of every being perfectly, or their past, or their future, or their karma, and knows exactly how to benefit them. Three, has such infinite empathy with every being. It's as if your mind is linked to every being in the universe. And you have this infinite power, effortless, to manifest your mind effortlessly and simultaneously in millions of bodies throughout the universe, only to benefit sentient beings. Now, of course, this sounds like science fiction. No science fiction I've ever heard is anything remotely as outrageous as what Buddha's saying we can accomplish. Okay, that's what a Buddha is. Buddha says that's what we can accomplish. Now, there's this wonderful story about the Dalai Lama. People say, oh, he's a Buddha. I don't know. I have confidence he would be. All the best people I know, like Lama Zopa and the others, say he is. That's good enough for me. But I can't tell you with certainty. I'm not clairvoyant yet. But he's a nice person. Anyone can see that. So there he is. We see this nice Tibetan gentleman. He's 80-something now, looking handsome and wonderful, you know, running. People love him in the world. But if he's a Buddha, This is just one form of his mind. I mean, he's manifesting in millions simultaneously in all the realms of existence, doing whatever he needs to benefit sentient beings. That's how they talk. So now, there's this lovely story. Lama Zopa told this years ago about how in the early 60s, very early 60s, soon after the Tibetans came to India, all the lamas were desperate to get land so they could get monasteries so they could carry on their knowledge, you know, because it would die out otherwise, all the lineages would die out. And that was their main concern. So at some point they were negotiating. His Holiness had his own exile government in Dharamsala, and he was negotiating with the Indian government about hundreds of thousands of acres of forest down in the south of India, which they were going to get, which they now indeed have. So it was a very difficult time. And so His Holiness sent his particular minister down to Delhi, where the government is, to have a meeting with the appropriate Indian minister. And the first time he got down there, he just couldn't get a meeting, you know, Indian bureaucracy being the way it is. So he gave up and went back up to Dharamsala. He took the train back up to Pathankot and took the taxi and went up there, and he got all frustrated. And His Holiness said, "Don't worry, it'll be okay. You go back right away." So he went down to Delhi again. And that particular day, The Indian minister's little boy was in the office with his daddy, and he was talking to the Tibetan, and the little boy expressed the wish for a dog. Well, the Tibetan was very happy. He wanted to grease the wheels, you know, said, "Oh, I'll get you a dog." So he went outside, and there was a sadhu, you know, Indian holy man on the street. You see them all over India with his yellow robe on and probably his marijuana pipe in his pocket and his hair on his head, with his makeup, his ashes all over his body, and he had a little dog. So the Tibetan said, "Can I buy your dog?" So he bought the dog, and the dog came in, and he gave it to the little boy, and the little boy's so happy, he runs to his daddy, and daddy's happy, everything works beautifully, and the meeting happens, and they start the negotiating to get the land. In fact, now all the land is down there, and all the monasteries are down there now. It's like literally Tibet down in South India. The point is this, though. As Rinpoche said, the sadhu and the dog were manifestations of the Dalai Lama's mind. I know this sounds demented to us, but this is the capability of bodhisattvas and Buddhas. So the Dalai Lama's mind, he's a Buddha, he's totally omniscient. He sees exactly what's necessary. So they facilitate things. And so, but what can we see? You know, when we're thick as posts, we can't see anything. You see a dog and a wacko Indian bloke. But they're both manifestations of the Dalai Lama. Now, the Dalai Lama didn't need to get born in a sadhu's mother. He can manifest as a sadhu. He can manifest as a dog. So if he can manifest as a dog and a sadhu, honey, Wolfgang, he can put his mind in a robot. But no one creates the mind. That's the point I'm making. You can't create a mind. You might create the condition for a mind. But what's interesting about the sadhu and the dog, because we think we see a dog, oh, is that a cute dog? You know, but you can't see. You'd never know that was a Dalai Lama's mind. You'd never know that was a Buddha's mind pretending to be a dog. Not possible. He wouldn't, you know, the dog wouldn't sit there kind of winking at you saying, "I'm really the Dalai Lama." He wouldn't have a little halo. He might even be a mean dog. You'd never know in a million years it was a Dalai Lama's mind manifesting as a dog, because we're not clairvoyant. Now, the interesting point about this, the Buddha can manifest as a dog, but that dog would never not be a dog. That dog would never not be the Dalai Lama. That's why the Christian teaching for the Buddhist view is very weird, that God can be perfect. God can create me, and then I can create a sin and cut myself off from God. That's not a possibility. That dog is not a dog. It would look like a dog. It would eat like a dog. It would die like a dog, but it is not a dog. It's just pretending. In fact, the Dalai Lama is not even a human. Human is a result of negative karma, of being still in samsara. Is good karma in comparison to the dog, but the Dalai Lama is pretending to be a human for our benefit. This is the point. So the actual meaning of the word Buddha is that all-knowing, all-unmanifest, all-loving, all-compassion, all-wise consciousness that pervades the universe and the result of the hard work of that person. But what good is that to poor human beings or the rest of us? The reason a person is a Buddha is because it's driven by their intense compassion to help us. So that Buddha has to manifest in bodies looking like us, because a bunch of peanuts we can't recognize. So that's the same as the concept of Jesus. Jesus is God in human form. It's exactly the same concept, just the same. But except the Buddha says there are trillions of Jesuses, which of course Christians don't think, because bodhisattvas can manifest in millions of bodies. And of course, we don't know who anybody is. Tibetans have a lovely saying, because we're all as thick as posts. We all believe what we see due to our limited delusions. There's a saying in Tibetan, we don't know who anybody is, so don't judge. So you'd see a dog, you'd never see anything but a dog, but you'd never know that wasn't the Dalai Lama. You'd never, because you're not clairvoyant, you know. So the Buddhas are running around helping all the time, manifesting in outrageous ways. This is the Bodhisattva teachings.
So I mean, the Bodhisattva,
huh?
Robin's asking, so then would it be a positive practice to see all of our conducive conditions as manifestations of the Buddhas or of His Holiness?
When we get to the Vajrayana level, the first level of practice, there's no wiggle room. You just back off and be a nice person. Don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't jump on the wrong partner. And you eventually extrapolate and realize that it also means you've been not stuffed too many cakes in your mouth. Cakes don't mind, but you're trying to discipline your body and speech. Then you harness that. Now you get to the next level. Now you start to become your own therapist, start getting your hands in your own SHIT and see all your rubbish mind and start to subdue the delusions because you realize these are the cause of your suffering. And you start to become a marvelous person. By now you're this amazing, subdued, happy, disciplined, content person. Then you go to the compassion wing and the really hard work starts, you know. And then you get to the Vajrayana and this is over the top outrageous. And here you are completely so qualified, if you're a really qualified person. You've got emptiness, you've got renunciation, you've got bodhicitta, and now the whole universe for you is like this illusory play. You see, and this is in when you take an initiation to a practice as a Buddha, say for example Tara, as a superior, as a blissful being, this is the most absolute in positive thinking. And we might even do a meditation before we finish, you know, we'll do one on Tara or something. It's like you're identifying with your marvelous potential. They call about these practices where you visualize yourself as a Buddha. You visualize all the universe as a pure land of a Buddha. You hear all sound as mantra. You see all beings as Buddhas. Even the mean people are wrathful, like you'd see Mr. Trump, if you hate him, as a wrathful Buddha, just showing you your mind. It's a whole different another level of practice. And yes, indeed, it's a profound level of practice. But you're not living in a fantasy land. If a maniac comes at you, you can very easily say, this is a Buddha trying to teach me, but you do your best to get out of their way. Don't be silly. Oh, well, there might be a Buddha. Please kill me. You be reasonable. But you don't know because we don't have a view of emptiness. We don't have a view of wisdom. We don't have bodhicitta. We've got tunnel vision, you know. We see everything as our own karmic appearances. So, yeah, it's an amazing view. But you've got to be qualified to see it like that and understand the reason behind it, not just live in some la-la fantasy land.
So I've got one more just question, then maybe we could have a five-minute break or something.
Yes.
But so Wolfgang, in regard to the mind, say from a materialist point of view, you'd be saying, well, this is just a theory, but there's no proof. You know,
Wolfgang, you've done the study, have you? You know definitively there's no proof? That's a serious question, Wolfgang. I need you to talk to me. You've looked back into the Indian literature. There's all the yogis literature of 3,000 years ago, of the Buddha 2,000 years ago. You've read all the teachings and you've looked into the proofs of all these beings who've shown you their experiences and you've proved it to be wrong, have you? I see. You're clever than I thought, Wolfgang. He's pretty clever.
No, not at all. In the first sentence,
Wolfgang, stop. You said there is no proof. How do you know? Have you even looked at it? How do you know there's no proof, Wolfgang? Have you studied it? Have you looked at the research? Have you looked at Buddha's experiences? Have you looked at what they said? And have you studied it? Well, you can't say there's no proof until you've looked at it. And then if you look at it, you then have to see if you think it's valid. And that means the only way you're going to prove it, the only way you can prove relativity. You see, this is a really good question, Wolfgang. This is how we are in the West, I may say. You know, we say, oh, it's relativity of that science. It's been proved. I don't disagree with you, but have you proved it? You cannot say that relativity is true for you until you have proven it. Some people have proven it. So the Buddha is exactly the same. He has given all his findings, exactly every word of Buddhism is his findings about exactly what a Buddha is. And that's coming from his experience. He's not asking you to believe it, but nor is Einstein. But we make the mistake in the West because one person's proven it. We say, oh, it's science. It's been proven. But it's not proved for anybody who hasn't proven it. It's mere faith until you have proven it. And that's the point. It's got to be experiential. So the Buddhism is exactly the same. Buddha is exactly the same as Einstein. So you've got to look into his experiential findings and look into it. First, get a theoretical understanding of it and have some intellectual confidence. And then you practice it step by step. That's the only way to prove it. There's no shortcut. Of course, there's proof. Of course there's proof, it's Buddha's findings right there and the people who've practiced it and studied it and taught it since. But not to believe it's that because we have an assumption that it can't be proved because it's stuff about past lives and stuff. That's because we've got a very limited view about what the mind is and what its capability is. Buddha's assumptions are very, very different. You get the point I'm making? Or not? Good. Thank you, Wolfgang. It's a really good point.
Thank you.